Today in Studio 360, the biggest museum in the world opens. Guess where?
Whoa, that's one mother of a Confucius.
At the newly expanded National Museum in China, the hallways are so long, you might want to bring some provisions.
And I have to admit, I've got a second pair of shoes in my backpack, and more comfortable shoes for going long distances.
And later, we'll meet the new star of contemporary R&B, Marsha Ambrosius.
She cheat on you with a basketball player. Hope that she Kim Kardashian her way up.
Her music is smooth and sexy, but Ambrosius is not playing it safe with the subject matter.
You want to sting the male ego when you've been bruised by a broken-hearted relationship.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That and lots more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today I'll talk with one of the classic Hollywood wheeler dealers, Jerry Weintraub. This
town. Jerry Weintraub is.
Jerry Weintraub is. Jerry Weintraub is.
He's a puncher.
He's a lot of things to a lot of different people.
He's Ringling Brothers. He's Barnum and Bailey.
He's tough as nails, but he has like a mushy marshmallow center.
He is the subject of a new star-studded documentary on HBO. But before we go Hollywood, let's talk about you and an older storytelling medium. Last week, we took a look at how independent bookstores are trying to stay relevant and profitable in the age of Amazon and the ebook.
If we're concerned about books, we're in paradise right now because the average resident of Missoula, Montana, has access to more of the world's literature now than the average resident of Greenwich Village did 20 years ago.
We asked where you buy books and whether you've made the leap to ebooks. And we touched a nerve. We got hundreds of replies. Listeners were almost evenly split between people who shop online and those who prefer a more old-fashioned physical book-buying experience.
Why settle for a virtual relationship when you could have a real one?
That is Anthony Mirabili from Philadelphia.
Books have a tactile, physical presence. Books are beautiful. There is art in the book cover. In the paper that is selected, in the font that is selected, and it's an expression of someone's art.
That's pretty much what about half our audience said. They love getting their hands on books and doing so among other people who like books. But unlike most of you, it's not just the charming little mom-and-pop bookstores that make Anthony feel warm and fuzzy.
I love the big chain bookstores, and I was shocked to see that more of your listeners don't agree with me. I don't know how you can't love them.
What do you love about them?
They're huge, they're clean, they're bright, they're filled with all kinds of books that I randomly arrayed that I never would have discovered clicking on the internet. You've got a coffee shop on the end if you want to kick up your feet and read a magazine. They're really tremendous. They have a variety of services and a level of newness and crispness that even the independent bookstores can't compete with.
So I assume in addition to not wanting to buy books online, you're probably not an ebook guy either.
I'm not yet an ebook guy. I have to confess to you though that I've played with an iPad at an Apple store and I thought it was fantastic. But it's still not the same sensation as holding a book and certainly being around book lovers. There's a quiet energy about it that I find very invigorating.
Listener Anthony Mirabili. And by the way, we find all of your responses invigorating. So keep them coming. We do really like hearing from you. This weekend in Beijing on Tiananmen Square, China's National Art Museum reopens after a 3.5-year expansion and renovation. they are touting it, inevitably, as the world's largest museum. And outside the building is a new giant statue of Confucius.
Whoa, that's one mother of a Confucius.
That's Jocelyn Ford, a reporter who has been based in Beijing for the last 10 years. She says the government hired German architects to expand and remake the building, and the first big special exhibit was organized by three German museums. It is about 18th century European art, the art of enlightenment.
And the fact that this museum, which was once basically extremely nationalistic, I mean, they were very proud that it was only Chinese architects who worked on the building. They had needed no foreign assistance whatsoever. The fact that they're now opening to the world is a change around. And the other thing is that this is, you know, it's not that politics is out. It's just sort of a new type of politics. China is emerging on the world stage. It wants to join the family of great museums around the world. It wants to be home to one of the greatest museums. And to do that, it's putting more of an emphasis on art, not just the politics and the teaching of the population about what, you know, they're supposed to think or do.
It's interesting, though, that they would sort of subcontract this first big show to Germans, as well as the design of the museum itself, and that it's about the European Enlightenment, which, of course, it's all about open-minded, unbounded curiosity, as opposed to guidance by tradition and the authorities, which the Chinese authorities don't see some irony or tension in that very fact?
Well, interesting you should say that, because I've been speaking to both the directors of the German museums and some of China's premier museumologists. And there is a famous Chinese saying. It says, same bed, different dreams. In other words, two people can sleep in the same bed and have completely different ideas about what's going on in the world and different dreams. And I think that's a perfect fit for this exhibition. When I spoke to Mr. Su Donghai, who used to be the director, he's now 84 years old, he used to be the director of the Revolutionary Museum, he basically said there's nothing political about the this art of the Enlightenment, it's just pretty art.
I think most of the works are paintings, and they represent the art of that period, not the relationship between individuals and the state.
Michael Eisenhower of the Berlin Museum had something else to say.
I think Enlightenment always is political, and Enlightenment is a part of the political reflections up to the present as well.
And then you have Mr. Khan Ackerman of the Goethe Institute, who's here in Beijing, an old China hand, at the Goethe Institute, of course, being the cultural arm. And he said the intention of the exhibition is to stir up a kind of debate or make people think.
But not in the way, let's show the Chinese what enlightenment is or how they should copy European enlightenment or so. I don't think it's not in that simple way.
But the subtext is they would like to bring up these issues, the issues of the individual in society, the issues of human rights in a Chinese context. And they're going through the back door, through art.
Right. Well, and you mentioned the director, Su Donghai. He's 84 years old, so he has seen it all, right? I mean, he was an adult at the time of the revolution, has been through all of the ups and downs of post-revolutionary history. So the net effect of this museum and where it's going is more a step forward than back.
Absolutely. If you think of China's economic development, they started by taking a little zone in the south of China and saying, okay, we'll let you play with capitalism here.
In Shenzhen,
across the border from Hong Kong. But in case it doesn't go well, we're just going to have a little tiny temporary experiment, which, of course, is now history. It's a huge booming city, leading manufacturers, the factory where the factory of the world is, essentially. And so in that same way, this museum, though, saying, you know, we're not changing too much, yet at the same time, they are opening up to a lot of new ideas. And, you know, who knows where it will go. But I think it is, in some ways, a brave experiment.
That's interesting. So this could be the beginning of a special cultural zone, in a manner.
Well, and Mr. Su Donghae mentioned this. He said, this is the National Museum and other museums will take note. And there is a huge museum boom going on in China. For example, I've seen one statistic that Shanghai alone plans to add 100 museums in 10 years.
In this day and age, in 2011, with this museum, new and improved, opening, did the political authorities exercise that kind of micromanaging curatorial authority or not?
Well, it's interesting. I went through some of the Chinese exhibitions, and I went with a young Chinese intern, and it was very interesting what her comments were. She saw some very beautiful art by some of China's more traditional painters from the last century, but in the explanations, they pulled out quotes such as, you know, Western culture prevails in the world today, but Chinese culture can compete with it, and she found it very defensive. In fact, she thought it showed they lack confidence.
I just feel like it's kind of let me feel like the China is a little bit lack of the confidence.
Lacking confidence.
Exactly. If you are confident, you don't need to always compare yourself with the West. You can just say, this is what we have. Do you like it? I like it. Just like that. We are Chinese. This is Chinese culture. And we really should to be proud. We are proud, but we don't need to always compare.
What made me more hopeful was that the next generation, she's in her mid-20s, is coming up and saying, we don't need to be defensive. If we have great stuff, we have great stuff. You know, why compare ourselves? Why not just let humankind appreciate what's good?
Well, I was struck that the official square footage of this museum is now, yes, bigger than the Metropolitan Museum in New York by 20,000 square feet. By this almost, one could imagine some architect being told, just a little bit bigger, please, by some authority.
Yes, one can imagine that. That plus the oversized Confucius.
Jocelyn Ford, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Jocelyn Ford is a reporter based in Beijing. You can see a slideshow of China's National Museum, now the official biggest museum in the world, at studio360.org. We'll be following the Chinese public's reaction to this grand Age of Enlightenment exhibit, especially now as the Chinese government is exercising its most intense free speech crackdown in years. This week, another human rights advocate was arrested, as was evidently a Chinese-Australian novelist. Since February, several activists, lawyers, and writers have been detained for their connection with the Chinese freedom movement. Coming up, busting a taboo in R&B. Marsha Ambrosius sings about gays and suicide.
Being the best friends of some people who just can't deal with life like that, it was only important that we incorporated that emotion into the record.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
And I know that you did the same. I guess I'm out of here. I'm moving on again. I'm sure that you will understand.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Hey, baby.
There is a new British invasion going on in pop music. And not rock, but R&B. One of the most interesting singers to come out of that UK scene is Marsha Ambrosius.
First of all, let me say that I missed you, baby.
She's been in the music business for a few years, but just released her debut solo album, which quickly became the number one R&B record in America. It also crossed over to the general pop chart, where it reached number two. But Ambrosius writes songs dealing with things R&B isn't known for, like homophobia and suicide. Eddie Robinson has the story.
R&B music is smooth, seductive. It's about good old-fashioned heterosexual lovemaking. It's not about issues or ruffling feathers. Leave that stuff to singers like Lady Gaga or M.I.A. Marsha Ambrosius is different. On her debut album, Late Nights and Early Mornings, her breakup songs aren't sad and mushy. They're caustic. One of them is called Hope She Cheats on You with a Basketball Player. You get the point fast.
I knew so many people would relate to that emotion. You want to sting the male ego when you've been bruised by a broken-hearted relationship. And versus me, you know, taking the light-hearted, easy way out. Oh, I love you. I'm so sorry that this happened and I wish you well. And no, I don't. Like, I'm a little bitter and I'm going to show you that. So I think with that record, I just spoke for all women that wouldn't. Like, you want to, you know, do the whole broken-hearted song, but that's been sung before. That song's boring.
And she loves to refer to music outside of the box of R&B. She covers an old song by Portishead, Sour Times.
As much as I'm a fan of theirs, I was more so a fan of the sample that they used by Lalo Schifrin, who's responsible for Enter the Dragon and Mission Impossible and Bullet. Like, that was one of my favorite composers, so when I heard them flip the sample, that made me love the song even more.
Circumstance will decide. See, nobody loves me. It's true.
I love film, but I absolutely love film scores. Like, I'll sing randomly the theme to Beetlejuice just because it's funny, but also because it's a wonderful piece of music. The Simpsons theme. Like, simple things like that enlighten me.
Marsha spent the early part of her career as half of a neo-soul duo, Floetry. The group had a couple of minor hits, and after years as a songwriter and producer for artists like Alicia Keys and Michael Jackson, Marsha's debut album is personal, defiantly personal, especially the newest single, a song called Far Away.
When I wrote the record in 2008 alongside Sterling Sims, who's a co-writer on there, Sterling and myself both had friends that had attempted suicide. And in going through that, being the best friends of some people who just can't deal with life like that, it was only important that we incorporated that emotion into the record. And it would be easy for me to, you know, write the song about a relationship I was in with my boyfriend at the time, and we're going through it, fighting back and forth, and, you know, I'm standing in the rain with the big hair and dramatic eyelashes, and that's, you know, it's standard, and it's been done before, and for me, I wanted to tell the story that wouldn't be told otherwise.
So sad to see you go so soon. I know that you ain't coming back.
The lyrics of Far Away are not too explicit, but the video comes as something of a shock. Marsha and a male friend, tall with a mustache, Yankee cap, are both walking in a park. They're hugging kids, getting smiles and high fives from a group of guys wearing hoodies. The next scene is at Marsha's apartment. They're having a glass of wine. Then another man comes in, bald and handsome. This guy gives Marsha a friendly hug and then kisses the first man on the lips. Later, the men are walking in that same park holding hands. Parents are pulling their kids away from them, and the men wearing hoodies look away in disgust. When Marsha's friend with the mustache finds himself alone in the park, the hooded men confront him with clenched fists and deliver a beating. Finally, we see his body lying in his living room, a spilled bottle of pills, a note, the cell phone blinking right by his hand. The video ends with a number to a suicide hotline. Online reaction to the video ranged from praise to fury. They're really trying to push their homo agenda. Being gay is a sin and is wrong for our children.
I remember seeing that quote, and I believe I responded to that and many other comments like that. And when I say many others, I'm talking about 10 for every 100. And for me, it was explaining that I'm not talking about what you think God believes. I'm making real music for real people. And this was a real situation that not only my friend had gone through, but others also. So even with these negative comments that came back, even when I replied, these are people that watched 1 minute and 12 seconds of a video and had no idea where it was going, what the message behind it was. And I said, look, for me, please watch the entire video.
Now, your friend is alive, mm-hmm. correct? Tell us about him.
We no longer speak, and it's strictly...
Why not?
I mean, we've communicated, but it's very distant, and it's because of the sheer embarrassment of the circumstance, and I totally get that. It's no love lost, it's a complete mutual thing, and I can deal with that, but I'm still thankful that they're here.
There's been a big shift in attitudes towards gays in America, but less so among African Americans because of strong church attendance, according to Pew Research polls. But if some R&B fans are upset, it's not hurting Marsha's career. The video for Far Away has been shown on BET and VH1. People are ready for it.
Whether it was negative or positive, people have opened that line of communication now, because the end result is suicide, the death of loved ones that we care about, gay, straight, black, white, whatever it may be. And I have to deal with me being the singer-songwriter of a song that was personal to me, which is now so personal to so many other people. And I can hold that responsibility.
It's not that Marsha wants to be more socially conscious or a gay rights activist. She did the video because it was about her life, something she went through.
So I think the gratification of having late nights and early mornings what it is because it was done under my terms. I wanted to write and produce my album. I wanted the album cover to look like this. I wanted to sing this song and have it be about this. I wanted to make this video. I wanted people to support it. And here it is, and I'm still Marsha Ambrosius from Liverpool. Never changed.
For Studio 360, I'm Eddie Robinson.
You can see the video of Marsha Ambrosius' song Far Away at studio360.org. Does the name Jerry Weintraub sound familiar? You have certainly seen it on movie credits. Lately, Ocean's 11 and 12 and 13, and back in the day, Nashville, Diner, and several Karate Kids. Maybe in the 1970s, you saw his name attached to a blockbuster concert tour or two. Led Zeppelin, Elvis Presley, Frank Sinatra. But that couldn't be the same guy. It is. And in show business, nobody has to ask who Jerry Weintraub is. He is a central casting mogul, a force of nature. His memoir is called When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead. And now he is the subject of a documentary called His Way, starring some people you've probably heard of, like George Clooney, Brad Pitt, and Julia Roberts, among others. It starts airing on HBO this coming week.
I'm sure he's got his funeral arranged already, and it'll be a great show. Be a fantastic show.
Not just as a producer, as sort of as a guy, he's one of the last of his kind.
No one ever, when asked the question, have you met Jerry Weintraub, has had to think about the answer.
And here with me now is Jerry Weintraub. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you're supposed to make movies. How did this come about, a movie about you?
A fellow named Graydon Carter,
I've heard of him.
You're familiar with. I came up with the idea of making a documentary about my life. But I wasn't sure I wanted to do it. I really was not sure I wanted to do it. And then I had dinner with Steven Soderbergh, actually, here in New York.
Who has made movies for you and
yes,
with you.
Many movies. And Steven said to me at dinner, if you're willing to go where I'm telling you to go, you're going to have a very important film. Not just a film, an important film. I said, where do you want me to go? He said, you got to go to the two women in your life. The story is Jane and Susie. Jane is my wife. Susie is my significant other. And he said,
your wife to whom you're still married.
Yes, I am still married for 50 years. Been with Susie for 20. So he said, if you'll go there to that place and you'll be honest about it and tell people why it's not a menage a trois, and it's not anything bawdy or gaudy.
It's an old-fashioned European arrangement, as
yes,
we used to say.
Yes.
And how about being in this film talking about you and this arrangement, both of these women? Was that a hard sell?
No.
No?
No, in fact, they're going on television together with me to talk about it, and they see each other all the time, and they cook in the same kitchen, and they're great friends, and they both love me.
And by the way, your wife is Jane Morgan, whom I grew up watching on old movies as a child.
Yeah, she was great. She's a great singer. Fascination, Day That the Rains Came, etc. And she was a big, big star and a very, very, very important part of my career.
And more beautiful to my eye at age whatever she is than age whatever she was 50 years ago.
Ah, that's sweet. That's sweet. She will listen to this broadcast over and over and over again after that.
Excellent. So that is the singular and surprising part of this film. But then let's go back to the reasons the film was made. This life you've had, these several lives you've had. You started out in the music business as a promoter of concerts.
Yes, I did.
So that's act one. Act two starts in your mid-30s when you happen to meet the director, the great director, Robert Altman, at a party and turn into a movie producer. Can you explain that?
Robert came to the party, and he and I somehow got off into the corner, and he said to me, you should make movies. Altman said, and I said, well, if I found something I wanted to make, I'd make it. I have plenty of places that want to make movies. He said, I have a script I'd like to send you. Would you read it? I said, absolutely, sure. He said, I'll have it here first thing tomorrow morning. He sent me Nashville. Joan Tewksbury wrote it. And I read it. I did not understand one page of the script.
Had you read scripts?
Yes, but I had no idea what Nashville was. And I challenge anybody today, even after seeing the film, to read it and understand what it was. So I called Altman up, and I said, I can't do this movie because I don't understand what it is. And he said, well, don't worry about the script. Just come and sit down with me. Let me explain it to you. So I did that. And after he explained to me what he wanted to do and how he was going to take these 12 stories and intertwine them, and it was a political drama about political assassination, et cetera, and all the country music we were going to do and so on, I got fascinated with the whole idea of it. And he was a fascinating guy. And I said to him, how much is this movie going to cost? And he said, it's going to cost $1,800,000. I said, okay, I'll do it. He said, what do you mean? I said, I mean, I'll do it. He said, you're going to write a check for $1,000,000? I said, yes. He said, no, you don't do it that way. You do it with other people's money. You do it with studio's money. The studio puts up the money. And I said, well, okay, I'll go to a studio. But in the meantime, I'm telling you I'm going to make it. I'm going to write the check, and I'm going to do it, which I did. And before I gave him the money and before I made the deal, I called a few friends of mine in the film business, and I said, what should I ask for? What do I need to protect myself? Because I'm in an area that I really don't understand. And they said, get final cut. I said, final cut, what does that mean? He said, that means that you have the final choice of what's in the film and what's not in the film. So I said, okay, I'll get final cut, no problem. I said, so I called Altman, and I said, I have to have final cut. What? He went mad. He went absolutely mad.
Which he certainly had the ability to do.
He went mad. He went through the roof. And he said, you can't have final. Who are you? You never made a movie. You don't know what you're talking about yet. I said, I really knew it was important. I said, if I don't get it, I'm not doing the deal. So he finally gave it to me. So I now had Nashville, and I had Robert Altman, and I had final cut. I now went to the studios, one by one by one by one. I knew everybody at every studio. And not one of them would talk to me about Robert Altman. They just wouldn't have. They just ran for the hills. They said, Robert Altman, he's crazy. You can't control him. And you don't know what you're doing with films.
And by the way, this movie, Nashville, was groundbreaking, but it had this huge ensemble cast without a very clear storyline or hero, although it is certainly one of my 10 or 20 favorite movies of all time.
Not five?
In the scene we're going to hear, Lily Tomlin plays a country singer being interviewed by a BBC reporter played by Geraldine Chaplin.
Let me see. Have you any children?
Yes, I have two children. I have a boy and I have a girl. Oh, isn't that nice? How old are they?
12 and 11.
Do they want to be singers like their mummy?
My children are deaf. They are deaf. They were born deaf.
Oh, my God, how awful.
No, it's
so
not.
Depressing.
No, now, just a minute. That's not so. I wish you could see my little boy. I want you to meet him.
I couldn't.
He has the most incredible personality.
It's the sadness of it. See, what happened is he
made millions. That was Nashville, all the characters sort of trapped on a highway after a crash. So as a producer, people know that, and you've talked about, you get deals made, you write checks, you raise the money, you get the distribution in place, you have power over casting. What else do you do as a producer on the films you've made?
Oh, I collect my money at the end.
Okay.
I put it in a bank and then I invest it.
So we can all be producers.
I do everything. You know, for instance, on Oceans, I try to create for the cast an atmosphere of camaraderie, because that's who those guys were, and fun. And I built a restaurant. On Ocean's 11, I built a restaurant on the lot. On Ocean's 12, I built a restaurant in Rome so that they could all eat together, be together. I do a lot of different crazy stuff.
Well, and I guess if
and then I sell it.
Yes. Well, and you were a guy who made Elvis Presley show up at concerts and Frank Sinatra on time. You were used to, shall we say, large and difficult egos.
Well, these guys that on Ocean's did not come to the set with egos.
Right. 20-odd years ago, you tried to create your own studio, which didn't turn out so well.
No, I failed.
Yes. Went bankrupt. Were you changed? Did you learn something?
Yeah, I learned a lot. I learned more from that experience. First of all, I made back the $30 million plus another $100.
You lost 30.
I lost 30. But I learned that I need to make the films. I learned that I'm not suited to sit around with a bunch of accountants and lawyers and human.
You're not suited to be a suit, I guess.
Yes, I'm not suited to be a suit. I'm not suited to sit around all day and talk about budgets and planning and what we're going to do in 7 years and 9 years and 14 years and how we're going to go public or not go public and who's in charge of human resources and how much we should spend on this and that. I'm not interested in that. That's not where my juices start to flow. I could do it probably if I put my mind to it, but I didn't like it. I was unhappy at that point in my life. And until I got back to making the films, I was not happy.
Do you have a 5-year plan?
Yeah, stay alive.
And in addition?
Stay alive.
Oh, really? That's it. Well, you show yourself half naked in the movie and you look pretty good.
Thank you.
Jerry Weintraub, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jerry Weintraub is the subject of a new documentary on HBO called His Way. And you can hear more from our conversation at studio360.org, including how the elder President Bush got him into restricted, super waspy New England clubs and why Weintraub didn't want to cast Pat Morita in The Karate Kid. Coming up, an architect who some computer scientists think of as a sage, a spiritual master, kind of like, you know.
He's like Yoda.
Really?
I think he's like Yoda.
A natural tendency there is for old people to gather together. No chance they have to benefit of older company. Treated like outsiders they are.
Listening to Studio 360, you are, from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion. What moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Now, picture your high school chemistry classroom. Bunsen burners, test tubes, that emergency shower contraption, but most of all, the big poster on one wall. That complicated jumble of boxes, letters, and numbers that is the periodic table of the elements. For scientists, the periodic table is a crucial and hugely coveted piece of real estate. And it's all thanks to a 19th century Russian chemist named Dmitri Mendeleev. This week in Design for the Real World, science writer Sam Keen explains the origin and enduring brilliance of the periodic table.
If you absorb nothing else from your education in chemistry class, the periodic table is probably the one thing that you can recall. One of the early tables was by an English chemist named John Newlands. If you look at the top of the periodic table, it repeats, it wraps around from the right-hand side to the left-hand side after eight elements. And Newlands compared that with the notes on an octave scale. But the scientists of the time were not too impressed with the musical analogy that he came up with. But a few of them had versions that are pretty close and pretty recognizable to the periodic table that we have now.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium.
There is a legend about Mendeleev playing a sort of chemical solitaire in his office where he would take the elements and be constantly rearranging them to try to improve his periodic table. And that's not quite true. But he definitely knew that having something easy to look at and an easy visual representation would be key to getting his ideas accepted.
Potassium, K plus one. Calcium, Ca plus two.
Basically, he had Cr columns and rows of elements, and he fit them so that elements with similar properties were in the same row. But between uranium, the element 92, and elements in the high 50s, scientists had no idea where exactly the elements should be arranged. And if you look at the original periodic table, there's actually a number of question marks by the elements. And it was a little frustrating for Mendeleev to have to leave gaps on his table. It actually turned out to be a boon for his table because he was able to predict the properties of new elements, which showed scientists that the periodic table could help them in their quest to discover new elements. The noble gases got their name because they're aloof elements. They don't interact with the rabble on the rest of the periodic table. So you might think of them as an aristocrat, somebody a little more noble. And when they were discovered, all they had to do was simply add a new column on the table. And because the elements, their weights fit in exactly between the weights of other elements, it proved that Mendeleev's table was flexible and able to accommodate new ideas.
Compound, a substance composed of two or more elements chemically combined in definite proportions by weight.
We're at kind of a special point in periodic table history right now, because the seventh row was recently completed. It's such an iconic image. It summarizes all of the knowledge that chemists have of how atoms work. And it's such a common tool around the world. It's really a universal idea. It's something that, even if we met, say, an alien civilization, that's probably one of the few things we would be able to converse intelligibly with them about. If they're at all smart enough to get to Earth, they almost certainly have discovered something like the periodic table.
Sam Keen is the author of a book about the periodic table called The Disappearing Spoon. KGHK's Becky Sullivan produced our story. You can hear all of our Design for the Real World segments at studio360.org. When I was graduating college, I read a brand new book that architects I knew were just raving about called A Pattern Language. The book was by an Englishman named Christopher Alexander, and he urged architects and city planners to think about the work they did in a more emotional and even spiritual way. But the book also had a very surprising influence on another group of experts, the computer scientists who were beginning to shape the internet. As part of our series on science and creativity, Studio 360's Lou Olkowski looks at what Christopher Alexander has wrought.
Okay, so Bauman, where are we?
A few paces away from the Cooper Union for the advancement of science and art.
My friend John Bauman studied art here at Cooper Union, and we've come to the library to look at a book. Apparently, it's so big or important that they won't let it out. It's by the architect, Christopher Alexander, and it's called A Pattern Language.
Oh, right. This is not a big book. It's a cute little book.
The book is cute. Even though it's over 1,100 pages, it miraculously fits in your hands as easily as a paperback. And actually, that makes perfect sense. Christopher Alexander is all about making things comfortable and easy to use. Still, the book is unusual.
First of all, it's not a typical book. It's a list of things that are organized in kind of increasing complexity. Later on, the book becomes a real book. But the beginning of the book, it's like, whoa, what is this? Lace of country streets. Subculture boundary, identifiable neighborhood, ring roads, canvas roofs, climbing plants,
degrees of publicness,
network of learning,
old people everywhere.
I mean, this is not architecture.
My interest is in making the earth a beautiful and harmonious place, and to prevent the situation that has been going on probably for about the last half century, where everything is becoming more and more ugly. It's a devastating thing.
When I speak with Christopher Alexander, he's at his home in the English countryside, sitting in a cozy chair.
I'm going to have a sip of tea. Lovely.
Looking out on the meadow where the sheep graze.
The sheep are not there today.
Chris thinks ordinary people could design better homes and neighborhoods than professional architects, if only they had the knowledge to do it. So his first step was to methodically study buildings and cities throughout the ages to identify recurring patterns, things that just worked again and again.
But very simple things, not pretentious things, real small stuff. Like there's some place to put a package down when you come to the door. So this is not a great intellectual feat, but I wrote it down because people in architecture weren't doing things like that. And most of these patterns in the pattern language were about human feeling, because after all, the point of the patterns was to make the buildings work so that people would feel really good.
Canvas roofs, climbing plants, paving with cracks between the stones, which it's pretty hippy-dippy. But, you know, that's the great thing about Alexander, too, that it's so hippy-dippy. I'd like to live in a place that had, you know, communal gardens and old people living with young people. I think there's even stuff like that in here. There, old people everywhere.
Read that to me.
Old people need old people, but they also need the young, and young people need contact with the old.
A New York Times article compares Alexander to a Zen master. My friend Bauman says,
he's like Yoda.
Really?
I think he's like Yoda. A natural tendency there is for old people to gather together. No chance they have to benefit of older company. Treated like outsiders they are.
Alexander's ideas never really took off in mainstream architecture. So the people who think Chris Alexander is like Yoda are mainly computer programmers. And in the 1980s, they were building a world too, a different world, a virtual world.
It's hard to understand what computers were like back then, but they weren't any fun.
That's Ward Cunningham. He invented Wiki, the code that enables Wikipedia.
There was no color. There were no pictures. There was no interaction of substance. There was no sound.
And we knew that the computer was changing. We knew that they weren't going to be in classrooms much longer, that there would be a computer in every desk, in every home, maybe multiple, and that people would do things for themselves on it, not things that they had to do.
So Ward and some others set off on a mission to take Chris Alexander's ideas about patterns and make computers that would feel good to use.
We've been looking for a way to describe how to write programs that embraced the user, that where the user felt that they were supported by the computer program instead of interrogated by the computer program.
Among programmers, it was called the patterns movement.
Alexander believed that people built well in the past and had kind of lost the ability to make great cities. We didn't think people had ever made great computer programs, and so we wanted to harvest those patterns.
Ralph Johnson co-wrote a book called Design Patterns. It became the Bible of the movement.
I mean, the pattern is that things repeat. That's what a pattern means. But then we say, why do they repeat? Well, the reason why this solution repeats is because there's a problem that repeats.
At the core of these programmers' philosophy is something called QWAN, Q-W-A-N. It stands for Quality Without a Name.
What Christopher Alexander meant by that is, it's the quality that things have that sort of make you feel like they're alive.
Yeah. Can you describe for me this idea of QWAN? What is QWAN?
QWAN.
Do you know this QWAN?
Never heard of it. What is it, a type of cookie?
QWAN, quality without a name.
Oh, QWAN. I've never heard it called that before. They're a wacky bunch. But of course, the quality without a name is something that I wrote about a great deal. The quality without a name is a situation where somehow the essence of life is present.
Life creates it, makes it grow.
It's intangible.
Its energy surrounds us and binds us. Luminous beings are we, not this crude matter. The tree, the rock, everywhere. Yes.
And so how does that apply to computer programming?
Do you nothing that I say?
Well, what one would hope is that pieces of software make each person that encounters that software more of a person. We're all of us capable of doing harm to other people by simply treating them or our transactions as something machine-like. That danger is right there at the core of it, and yet this very computer phenomenon also has the capacity to go to a much, much richer place that actually makes a person, man, woman, child, more humane and more caring.
Alexander's goals for computer science and architecture may sound mystical, but they grow from his sense of pragmatism. He honestly wants to make the world more beautiful. It's not enough to create just one good building or neighborhood and then mass produce it. To really change the way the world looks and feels, every person needs to create harmony in his surroundings. That's one reason Alexander's relationship with the programming community has been so inspiring for him. They understand how to work on a global scale, and many of them have similar goals.
We want to make the Earth better. We want to make it a better place. And all the computer scientists that you've been naming to me, they take that seriously. And it's funny because it's not something that you really associate with computer science. But that is, I believe, what moves them, as it does me in the things that I do.
Now Alexander's working with programmers at the University of York in England on something called the Cosmos Project. They're creating computer simulations of complex organic systems. In other words, simulations of things that just work in nature. His dream is to create a new kind of operating system. Imagine sitting down at a computer that was more than just a mechanical tool. Imagine a computer that could actually teach you how to make whatever you're designing more beautiful. Alexander admits that as of yet, programmers have no idea how to do it. For Studio 360, I'm Lou Olkowski.
Please give any of my friends that you run into my very warm greetings.
I'm sure they feel them like the Force.
And that is it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Lital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Michael Guerriero,
Eric Malinsky,
Rob Weisberg,
Sarah Dalia,
Mary Dew,
Katie Palmer.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegel.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at Scion.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the Civil War. Did it ever really end?
You know, some would rather leave that wound closed. Those who don't want to hear the story, those who don't want to tell the story, are part of the problem, not part of the solution.
Remembering the War Between the States. Next time in Studio 360, from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.